So let us just fire away. See what this gets us. We'll just finish off the questions from yesterday, first of all, and we'll go move on to the other ones afterwards. Dear Ajahn, why is it difficult to rebirth back to the human state? Why is that hard? Well, basically, it's not that hard. If you behave well, if you are kind, and you do the right things, it's not so difficult. The problem is that the vast majority of people don't do those things that they need to do to be reborn as humans, right? That's the problem. So it's not so much that it's hard, it's just that people have the wrong information, they have the wrong religion, they have the wrong ideas about life, do kind of all crazy stuff, and they don't get reborn back as humans again. Of course, one of the important points here is this idea of non-self, right? So sometimes we think that we are in charge, I'm going to look after my rebirth by doing all the good things and this kind of stuff. But the reality is that in the long run, you're not really in charge. In the long run, you are just a victim of the conditions, right? So one life you are a good Buddhist, the next time you are a really bad person. And things just go around like that, depending on how you are conditioned in one life to the other one. So even though it feels like you're in charge and you're making the good choices, all these kind of things, actually very often you're not. You're just pushed into this box. And you are trapped by whatever conditions are working on you. So this is part of the reason why it is so hard to get back as a human being, because we are blind and deluded and we don't know what's going on. Number two, once the arahants are passed away, are they vanished in the universe and no more trace of them, like what the Buddha said, just like a candle going out, everything ended. Yes, that's essentially right, because remember the point of the Buddhist path is to end suffering, right? And that is really the whole point of this path. And that is the most important thing. That's what really matters. But to actually understand the nature of suffering, the only way you can understand that is to understand non-self. And because we don't understand non-self, it's very difficult to get to grips with the idea of what suffering actually means. So the end of suffering can really only be understood when you fully understand non-self. And this is a weird thing, because once you see non-self, it changes your entire outlook. It changes what is important, right? And then suddenly the ending of rebirth seems great. You don't really care what comes after, as long as rebirth is ended, it doesn't really matter. You just want to get rid of the suffering. So as long as the five khandhas are there, remember the five khandhas are suffering, right? According to the First Noble Truth. As long as there's some remnant of the five khandhas, then you will have a problem. And the five khandhas are very inclusive. They include everything from consciousness to feelings or whatever. There's nothing really, no aspect of a human being which is outside the five khandhas. That all comes to an end, and that's when you don't suffer anymore. And that is what matters. That is what you should focus on at the end of suffering. That is actually the critical issue now. So what exactly that means in terms of what happens when the arahant dies is kind of irrelevant. The point is that suffering ends. That's actually the important thing. Okay. Dear Ajahn, last night, in other words, two nights ago, I could not sleep until 3 a.m. Okay, and did you get up for the 6 a.m. meditation as well? That would be very impressive, right? A couple of hours of sleep, then kind of... Okay, anyway, thoughts of ghosts in my room consumed me. I had scary thoughts. This is partly my fault. Too many movies and imaginative mind. I could not meditate because of... any sound I heard was related to the ghost making it. How can I calm myself? I know you said to not fear ghosts, but I don't have the wisdom or power yet. Thank you very much. Okay. So maybe, I'm not sure who wrote this. Maybe this was one of the Thai people, because they are famous for being afraid of ghosts. But maybe it can be anyone. If you see too many movies, then yes, that's part of the problem with seeing scary movies with all kinds of weird creatures in there. So basically, it's very simple. How can you calm yourself? Very easy. Stop watching those movies, right? This is number one. Don't do that, because it does have an impact on you. It's kind of these things linger, right? Sometimes we like to watch horror movies because sometimes just because it makes us feel alive. You watch a horror movie, you feel, oh, this is really, it makes you alive. But then you get a little bit too alive, and these things carry on in your imagination for a long time afterwards. And this is part of the actually very bad problem. So don't watch those things. This is a waste of time. It just messes up your psyche and all kinds of things, you know. I never really, in the dark, maybe sometimes you feel a little bit kind of, because you hear some strange sounds, you think, oh, what's going on? But generally speaking, because I haven't watched any scary movies for 25 years or something, it's kind of completely in the past, right? All of those things. And after a while, nature is just nature. You don't even think about these things anymore. I basically live in a little hut by myself. I mean, a hotel room is nothing compared to a hut by yourself in the forest. that's what I do, right? And it's no issue. And the reason it's no issue is because all of those things are disappeared into the past. So don't worry, and even if there is a ghost there, just have metta towards the ghost. Oh, welcome ghost, how are you? Right? And when we have that kind of attitude, it's like you turn everything upside down. If you welcome the ghost isn't scary anymore. Just like the zombies, if you give the zombie a hug, the zombie isn't scary anymore. Right? Similar kind of things. So just turn, it's just use psychology to turn things around. And then you should be fine. So, if there are ghosts around, it's much better to go to sleep, because then you don't know they're there, right? They disappear. So very smart to go to sleep then, rather than stay awake. Yeah. Okay, so good luck to you. And see what happens. Okay. How does karma ripen? If I had killed some insects or rodents when I was young in my folly and ignorance, when will I reap the consequences of my unskillful actions? Okay, so when is it going to happen? First of all, it happens straight away often. You kill something and straight away you feel bad about it. Karma number one in this life. Ditteva dhamma karma in this very existence. Then, if you carry that guilt or that negativity with you in your mind when you die, right? Remember the point here is that these bad actions of us, they affect our consciousness. So if you carry that with you to the moment you die, which you will to some extent, it means that your mind, your consciousness, is held down by those actions. And then it has an effect when you get reborn, because your consciousness just tends to continue where it is in this life. So if you drag yourself down, you continue at that lower level into your future life. If you lift yourself up, you continue at that high level in your future life. Right? That's how it ripens. It's actually quite simple. There's nothing kind of very mystical or magical about it. And then maybe because your consciousness is low, it kind of attracts all kind of negative things in your future life, and then bad things happen to you. But if your consciousness is bright and beautiful, it attracts bright and beautiful things, and things are beautiful in your future life. Right, it's like in this life. The reason why, one of the reasons why you have so many good friends is because you are a good person. You hang out with people like this, right? And this is, life tends to attract like. That's just how things are in this world. That's one of the best things about being a monk is that you meet so many good people, both monastics and lay people and everywhere. It's a wonderful, wonderful thing. So, don't worry too much about that. We are all foolish and ignorant. We have all done such bad things. So forgive yourself for those things. Realize you were just a victim of the conditions at the time. Very hard to know exactly what will happen. But if you are a victim of the conditions, if it's non-self, it's not really your fault. So let it go. And then hopefully it will have very, very little effect in the rest of your life. And just keep doing good things, and this that will dilute the effect of any bad karma you have made. Okay. Some Buddhist monks claim that abortion is killing. So if a woman has an abortion, she will go into the hell realm and suffer horribly in the next life. Is this true? What does the sutta say about abortion? Okay. So first of all, even if you kill somebody, right? Even if you kill somebody, it doesn't mean you go to hell. All you have, you kill one person, and then you regret that afterwards, and you make sure that you do the right things later on. That is no guarantee that you will go to a hell well. Remember Angulimala, right? The famous story. I think that story is probably a bit exaggerated, because it's, you know, when you read the story, it looks a bit over the top. When you compare it to the other versions of that story in the Chinese arguments, they are quite different. So there has been some elaboration going on there. But I think the kind of root idea that somebody killed somebody and then still they were able to reach the end of the path, that root idea is probably true. Right? So you can become an arahant, for goodness sake, if you have killed somebody. This is talking about going to hell. It's the exact opposite of going to hell. It's the highest possible thing you can do. So that's even if you kill somebody. Now, if you have an abortion is usually much less than killing somebody. If you kill a fully grown human being, it's very different from having an abortion. Sometimes an abortion is like a very early stage, right? It's more like an insect than a human being at the very early stage. So what are you actually killing? It's more like you're killing an insect. How bad is it to kill an insect? Not very bad, right? It doesn't cause enormous harm in the future. So it all depends on so many factors. It depends on the size of the fetus. It depends on whether the mind has already arisen in that fetus. If there is no mind there is no bad karma at all, because you're not hurting anybody, right? There's zero bad karma. If the mind has arisen in the fetus, exactly when that happens will vary from situation to situation, so it really depends a little bit. If the mind has arisen, then one of the main factors of the karma is the motivation. Why are you doing it? Right, and sometimes these things are done because it is just very hard and very difficult, and you do it perhaps out of hopefully a certain amount of wisdom, and a certain amount of compassion is included in that. The more there is that compassion and wisdom, the less bad it is. If you do it because you hate this fetus, well, of course, then it is not so good, right? So there's all these factors in there that actually matter. And all of it is not black and white. Buddhist ethics are grayscale. From dark stuff, you know, where it's very dark, where you're very angry and upset and you do bad things as a consequence, to very bright actions, like when you come out of samadhi and you do acts of, you know, extreme kindness in a sense. But most acts aren't like that, they're somewhere in between there. So remember that, it's mostly grayscale, so we try to kind of do acts that are on the brighter side of gray, not the darker side of gray. This is really how it works. So just ask yourself, what is your intention? Of course, it is good to avoid these things. You don't really want to get yourself into a position where you have to have an abortion. It's not nice anyway, right? I think most women don't particularly enjoy that kind of thing, so it's probably a good idea to avoid it regardless, of course. But remember that this is not something as extreme as that. So it's important to keep these things in perspective. Yes, please.
Can I ask you, according to Buddhism, what is the age of the fetus when it has consciousness?
This is a problem. It's actually very hard to gauge that from the suttas. There is one sutta which says that three factors have to come together for there to be for the fetus to kind of start, to arise, for there to be a conception. It doesn't actually say conception, it says for the fetus to materialize. And that is, there has to be another being present. The mother and father have to come together, and there has to be the mother has to be at the right time, right, the right season or whatever. Those are the three things. But it is the interesting thing about this is that it's only mentioned twice in the suttas, and one of the occasions mentioned as a view that existed in the India already at the time. So it looks like this is a view that this was prevalent in India at the time, and was taken on board by the Buddhists because they didn't have any particular view about this. So it's there's a lot of, I think, anecdotal evidence around that consciousness often can enter the fetus quite late, during pregnancy. So it is very, very hard to know. And I think it probably varies a lot from person to person. And that is why there is no kind of guarantee one way or the other. But generally speaking, if you are going to have an abortion, it's good to do it the earlier the better. The earlier it is, the less chance of being any consciousness there, and also the being that you are living is much less developed. The less developed it is, the less bad karma it is. Okay. Who wrote the suttas? How do we know that they are the true words of the Buddha? Okay, so who wrote the suttas? Okay. Well, they were only written down by about 350 to 400 years after the Buddha, depending a little bit on which suttas you're talking about and all this kind of things. But generally, they are considered to have been written down in Sri Lanka around 50 BC. That's only a rough figure. There would have been suttas that were written down before that, and this is only the Theravadan school. There are other schools where they may have been written down at different times, so it's not entirely clear when they were written down. How do we know that they are the true word of the Buddha? Okay, this is, I think, a very important question, right? Because I'm sort of claiming all the time that this is the word of the Buddha. So why, how do we, what is the evidence for this? And there is actually a book. I myself, Adasudata myself, we wrote a book about this. It is called The Authenticity of the Early Buddhist Text. And it was published by the Oxford Center for Buddhist Studies, right? Really prestigious. We were very happy about that they wanted to publish that book. Yeah. So you can actually go online and you can go to the Oxford Center for Buddhist Studies and you can actually download that book, because it's available for free. Yeah. It's only copyrighted for 1 year, and then they publish everything for free on the internet. So The Authenticity of the Early Buddhist Text is the name of that book. And you can read about a lot of the details in there. But basically, the evidence is one of the main parts of the evidence is what we would call textual analysis or textual understanding, or comparative studies, it is sometimes called. There's many different types of textual study, but one of them is a comparative analysis. And what that does, it recognizes that the Buddhist tradition is very diverse, and different schools started to separate from each other at a fairly early point. A lot of that separation happened at the time of Ashoka, right? Emperor Ashoka, he was ruling about 265 BC. So this was probably less than 150 years after the Buddha, so very soon after the Buddha. And he was very big on spreading Buddhism around the world, sending it, you know, to all of India and sometimes even beyond India. So he was almost like a missionary king in many ways, or emperor. And so at that time, there was a lot of spreading out of Buddhism. And we know that because he talks about this in his edicts. Ashoka was very famous for the Ashokan edicts that were engraved on rock in different, lots and lots of different locations around in India. There were also the Ashokan pillars, very famous pillars that were erected around India, and they exist to the present day, with all sorts of inscriptions about what he was doing and this kind of thing. And it looks from those that he was doing missionary activity, the way he talks about that. We also know that in the Pali books, this is quite an interesting piece of history actually, in the Pali book called the Samantabhasadika, which is a commentary on the Vinaya Pitaka, right? This is a commentary, it's not actually the word of the Buddha, we know that for certain, but it's a commentary. And in that commentary, it talks about certain Buddhist saints that spread Buddhism around India, right? So they give the names of these people and they say they went to such and such locations, right? And what is very interesting is that when some of the relic chambers at Sanchi is a very famous Buddhist site in India, we have these big stupas, etc., and some of the reliquaries there were opened up, and when they opened them up, they found in boxes with ashes of certain monks. And those monks who were there, they were matched exactly with those monks who were found in the Samantabhasadika, that were written down in Sri Lanka, right? But it's very interesting because Sanchik is in the north of India, or you know, not entirely in the north, but slightly central. And the Theravada text, Samantabhasadika, was written in Sri Lanka. It's about 2,000 kilometers apart or something. Very different, different era, time period, everything very different. And there's a very close match between the names and also between what they were doing as monastics. So it looks like we have some very good evidence that this spreading out of Buddhism was actually happening around that time, especially at the time of Ashoka. So what exactly did that spreading consist of? And one of those spreadings, of course, was when Buddhists went to Sri Lanka. We know Mahinda and Sangamitta. They went to Sri Lanka and started both the nuns' order and the monks' order there. That was supposed to be definitely during Ashoka's time. Mahinda was supposed to be the son of Ashoka, Sangamitta his daughter. So we had this, so that seems to be fairly well established. I don't think anybody has any arguments with that. But then there was also, at that time, there was monasticism spreading to the north of India, right? Up to Kashmir, up to Gandhara. Gandhara is now in Pakistan, so way up in the north of India. And these, at this time, it was still quite unified Buddhism. But eventually, these schools, or these people that went to the north, they became the Sarvastivadin and the Dhammaguptaka schools. Right, so basically we had different lineages, different geographical areas where the suttas were kept by monastic community. One was in Sri Lanka, one was in the North India in Kashmir. It's over 3,000 kilometers in between, right? That's a long distance. How far is it from here to Singapore? It's longer than from here to Singapore, right? We're talking about big, big distances here now. So, and then, the suttas were kept in Sri Lanka, were kept in Kashmir by the Sarvastivadins. From Kashmir, they went on the Silk Road all the way into China. They were translated into Chinese. That's why we now have the Chinese canon. A lot of the Chinese canon, the early part of it, which is called the Agamas, came from the Sarvastivadin school, which I was just talking about. So then it is very interesting, because we have early suttas in Chinese translation, a few in Tibetan translation, some in Sanskrit, some in Pali. And then we take it all together, and we can compare them, right? And this is what is so interesting. Sometimes there have been some minor changes, because that's what you can expect when things have been kept apart for 2,300 years or whatever. You would expect some changes. But what is much more remarkable in that actually there is enormous amount of similarities between these things. I was just mentioning the other day, we were looking at the sutta called Dependent Liberation. You know, just this morning, starting off with virtue, non-regret, gladness, joy, etc., all the way to samadhi, seeing things according to reality. That sutta, as I said, is almost exactly word for word the same in Chinese translation. Right? It's astonishing. How is that possible after 2,300 years? It's almost mind-blowing. And this is the sort of thing you can see in sutta after sutta. Like, for example, the jhana formulas, a very standard set of formulas. They're almost exactly the same in Chinese as they are in Pali. In a couple of cases, they aren't exactly the same. And there are some tiny, tiny variations in other cases. The gradual training, it looks... There are slightly more variations there because it's a long sutta, but roughly it is, again, very, very close. And this is very interesting. And what it means, of course, is that the Buddhist tradition has been very conservative. Buddhist tradition, it was very important for the monastics to feel that they were preserving the word of the Buddha in the right way. You can imagine, if you really had strong faith in the Buddha, you put every effort you could to preserve that word, right? It's sort of natural that you should be conservative. You shouldn't say, yeah, he actually meant this, or cross out that and write something else, right? I mean, you would do that kind of stuff because you would have a lot of confidence in the Buddha. So it's natural that they were conservative, and that is exactly what we see. We see this tremendous conservatism. Going back to the time of Ashoka, we're talking about the Buddha existed maybe 150 years to Ashoka. If everything was so conservative for the past 2,300 years, my guess is it was also conservative, perhaps even more conservative, in the first 150 years. Right? And this is how we can know with a high degree of certainty that what we have actually is the word of the Buddha. This is part of it. There's much more to that question as well, such as the geography, the politics at the time. We can compare that with historical documents about these things. And if you're interested, have a look at that book about the authenticity of the early Buddhist texts. It's actually quite an interesting, I think it's quite interesting, and it summarizes the arguments quite nicely. It's a little bit academic, I have to warn you. It's not... But if you enjoy that kind of thing, you might enjoy it.
Sorry, this is the wrong question. How were the suttas then preserved from the time of the Buddha's death till King Ashoka's time?
Yeah, well, basically it was oral tradition, right? But that oral tradition also continued after Ashoka, because Ashoka was about 260 BC, and they were written down maybe 50 BC. That's a 200-year gap. So we know that the oral tradition also is very accurate. Otherwise, it wouldn't match, right? So we know that that also was very accurate. Remember that these Indians, they were specialists in oral literature. They had collected the Vedas, right? The Vedas that had existed for maybe 1,000 years before the Buddha. And we know apparently from history that those Vedas were remembered almost verbatim, word for word, for 1,000 years. Right? How is that possible? And of course, the way it is possible is because after a while, you build up this technique in memory, which is incredibly precise. And because that was part of the Indian culture, the Buddhists would have inherited some of that. And this is one of the things that we actually do survey in that book. And we look at the parallels between how the ancient Indians preserve texts compared to how the Buddhists do it. And we can see the parallels there. Yeah. Okay. We can talk about that topic all night, so we're going to stop there, because it's interesting and it's very extensive. So, okay. Sort of make out a bit of blurry stuff, but it's not good enough. Okay. So, dear Adam Ramali, question number one. Okay. I do not follow the five precepts. I just try my best to do good and minimize any negative impact on others. Hence, will I have a chance to get enlightened? Okay, so it depends what you mean by that, right? It depends how you do that. If you live generally a really good life, you follow the five precepts by default, probably, right? Many people do that. Because many people are naturally good. They may never have heard of the five precepts, they may never actually even think about that. But still, they just do it as a matter of course, because they can feel inside of themselves what feels right. So if that's what you're doing, if you just don't take them officially, but you actually follow them and kind of then there is no problem. But remember that the five precepts, they are in many ways, they are like a distillation, if you like, of the most important moral precepts on the Buddhist path. So these are actually very important. If you think that you are kind, but you're not following the five precepts, then you have to ask yourself whether you actually need to kind of improve your morality a little bit. So it depends what you're not keeping. If it, you know, maybe it's drinking, I don't know what it is, or people find it very hard to stop drinking because all my friends drink. I have to do business. I can't drink. I can't do business without drinking. These are the kind of arguments you hear all the time. But the Buddha laid these things down for a reason. They are very important. They are core moral precepts. So if you're not keeping them, I would definitely advise you to kind of to start doing that, because they're going to be a very powerful support in your meditation practice. In fact, as I've been arguing on this retreat, it's good to go beyond that, to do more than just keep the five precepts, right? It is a great, very important and great foundation, but if you want to kind of really boost your path, it's better to do even more. Drinking coffee and eating meat, will it cause difficulty in meditation? I don't think so. As long as you don't kill any animals or whatever, then eating meat should not really be a big issue. I notice that eating meat makes me easily annoyed at things. Oh, okay. Well, in that case, maybe best not to eat it, right? But this is kind of an important point. We have to go with what it feels like for us. Instead of just being kind of blindly reliant on precepts and what other people say, feel for yourself what works for you. And if that is the case, then, you know, then don't eat meat, because it's important to have a purity of the mind. I'm wondering whether there is a link between diet and meditation, as I think Mahayana prescribes strict vegetarianism. Yes, but apparently the reason why the Mahayanas do that has nothing to do with Buddhism as such. I was told that this had more to do with the culture in China at the time. There was some emperor apparently at a certain stage that decreed that from now on all the monastics must be vegetarian. And that's what happened. They all said, vegetarian. You can't go against the emperor, right? So the emperor that is saying, yes, sir, or yes, ma'am, and you kind of do what they say, yeah. Especially if they threaten you and all that kind of thing, yeah. So I don't think that has anything to do with Buddhism. But of course, there are good reasons to be a vegetarian regardless. And if people want to be vegetarian, I say good on you for doing that. It's obviously a very positive thing, yeah. But again, it shouldn't really be an obstacle if you don't want to be vegetarian, yeah. Number three, is there the requirement for me to start chanting? Example, the Shurangama Sutras. okay. If I want to invest wisely for my future lives, okay, I don't think the chanting the Shurangama Sutra is going to make massive difference for your future lives, to be honest with you. I think, you know, remember that the point with things like chanting, all the kind of things, it's supposed to have a point, right? It's supposed to do something for you. And if it does something for you, great, do a bit of chanting. Don't exaggerate the chanting. Sometimes I hear people who do an hour of chanting every day, and I think, wow, you know, what a waste of time, that's what I'm doing. So do it. If you like a bit of chanting because it makes you peaceful and it makes you calm, great. Do a little bit of chanting to do that. Or just listen to the chanting on your, you know, on your iPod or whatever, if you have some chanting there. Whatever it is, but do it purposefully. Either because it makes you feel peaceful, so you can meditate a bit afterwards. Or, even better, if you can understand what is going on, right? Some of these chants are actually real teachings. Some of them are not, so don't worry about those. You can focus on the ones that are real teachings. And if you understand that, it's very beautiful. Sometimes on retreats, we do the chanting of the Metta Sutta in English. And if you do that kind of first thing in the morning when you wake up, it kind of puts you in a good mood, right? It says, you know, it has all these beautiful qualities in there that you're supposed to live up to. And that kind of gets you started in a good day, a good way for the day. It can do, but maybe you don't like it, in which case it may not be the right thing for you. So don't do these things in a kind of blind way. Everything's supposed to have some sort of meaning, right? That is what is most important here. Yeah, and anyway, the Surangama Sutra is not even the word of the Buddha. It's a much later sutra that was, invented much later on. Some people seem to like that sutra. I was once given the Surangama by a very devout woman. She must read the sutra. It has really good stuff in it. And, you know, it matches with early Buddhism, etc. And I had a look at it, and it doesn't match all that well, actually. But anyway, so I'd like to speak to the early sutras myself. Okay. Yes, please.
The promotion of making merit,
that's where it's coming from. People ask China, million, oh my God. Yeah. Well, this is kind of weird, right? We have all these weird ideas about how to make merit, right? Making merit is about how you live your life. It's about being kind, being generous. That's what making merit is about. You're not going to make any merit by doing all this chanting stuff. But this is how it's true. It's actually everywhere in the world. You find that in Chinese Buddhist, probably in Sri Lanka. You find it across the world. All this chanting to make merit. Building stupas, another favorite one, right? Build stupas to make merit. Well, the way to make merit is if you are promoting happiness in the world. Now, how much happiness are you promoting by chanting the Surangama Sutta? Maybe not that much, right? So this is kind of these are the kind of questions that you ask yourself. But if you give a gift to a poor person, if you support a charity, if you support the monastic sangha, you support the people around you, you help to create happiness in the world. You're helping people, otherwise would have difficulties. Chanting the Surangama Sutta or any sutta is likely to have very little impact. We live in a, unfortunately, this is really about superstition and not really understanding what merit actually is. Merit is your intention to be kind, your intention to be compassionate, your intention to be wise. That is merit, right? That is real merit. All the other stuff is, sometimes it may have a tiny little positive effect. It's very hard to say it is no good merit, I may be too harsh. but it's tiny compared to the good acts that you do in your life. That is where the real merit lies, sir. So don't give any money to stupid projects, right? Building massive, it's just a waste of time. Give it to some poor people who are needy and who need to eat, sir. Much better. I'm a really kind of outrageous monk, right? I'm saying this. Oh, if other monks heard this, they would be really kind of, yeah, they would kind of kick me, or maybe they'll kick me out. Okay. Dear Arjuna, how can one control sexual urges when they arise? Okay, why do you want to control them? Are you on the 8 precepts? Is that what you are? Is that right? If you are practicing the 8 precepts and you have that, of course, you have to have a little bit of control. But otherwise, you know, that's part of ley life, isn't it? You have some sexual activity, that's just the way things are. I don't think you have to control it too much, unless, of course, it's some kind of bad sexual urge which kind of hurts other people. Then, of course, yes, you have to control it. But you don't have to control these things too much. It's good, of course, to kind of move to a life where, you know, you don't have to kind of, you don't want to overdo these kind of things. Because with everything, the more you overdo it, and the more you do it, the more kind of leads to more craving and more problems, whatever. So if you can reduce these things a little bit, it's good. And often you find out if your other parts of your spiritual life are going well, there is less need for these kind of things. It's not so much so important anymore. But don't worry too much about this, right? This is what I was saying before. The main problem in life, the one that is really painful and difficult, is anger, is ill will, and that causes so much problems. Sexual pleasures, including sexuality, is not such a big issue if it is done in a responsible and good way. Number 2, I experience nightmarish dream when I consume meat in certain stalls and restaurants. However, when I consume organically grown free-range meat, such experiences do not occur. Is it because I could relate to how these animals were slaughtered and killed? Okay. It is very hard to say. Perhaps you were feeling a bit guilty, right? And then this comes back in your dreams. It's possible that's the case. But I know a lot of people who don't have that kind of dreams and still they eat meat which hasn't been kind of animal that haven't been treated rightly. So I guess it depends. But if it affects your body, again, go with your own experience, what is your life, and then find out what works for you. That is the most important thing, right? So if part of that is a good thing, do that. Do the free-range meat rather than the meat that has been slaughtered in the wrong way or whatever. So just feel what works for you. And then over time, you start to kind of take charge, in a sense, of your own spiritual path. And this is kind of the most important thing, yeah. Yes, sir.
Question on the sexual urges one. I mean, you mentioned that we don't have to deal with it so much, but what happens in certain situations, like, for example, as I become a manager, for example, right, and there are new people coming in, and sometimes there are like these like attractive young girls who start to like, you know, start to have develop like crushes and stuff like that. So how do you, as a, you know, monastic, like, deal with similar kind of situations?
So
I think that would be couple of like guys in a similar situation.
I just have to ignore it then. it's off-putting if you ignore it completely. Yeah. It's very off-putting, yeah. And then you get the message very quickly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah. So just not interested. Yeah. But people feel that very quickly if it's coming from an honest place, and then it's no problem. Yeah. Okay. Okay, Thai people believe strongly in amulets and blessings imbued in the amulet by monks. Is it true that these amulets have power to protect for good luck, etc.? All the stories that I hear about amulets are really bad stories, you know. They're so expensive, you pay thousands of dollars to get a really powerful amulet that is blessed by a certain monk and that kind of stuff. But there are some really interesting stories about that. There was one story about some general or something who had got this amulet, and they said, this amulet makes you absolutely invincible. It is impossible to kill me now that I have got this amulet. And so this other guy who was there said, okay, I've got a gun, can I just can I shoot you? And he said, go ahead. And he shot him, and he died. So this is kind of the stupidity, right? Absolute stupidity of these kind of things. So the way, if you want to be protected, it actually says in the suttas how you should be protected if you want to be protected. The best way to protect it is to keep the five precepts, to live a good life, to be kind, and all these kind of things. That is when you are protected. It's the power of doing that. How that works, it probably works in many ways, but if you are a good person, you tend to stay out of trouble, right? This is the first way it protects you. You hang out with other good people. This is the second way it protects you. And then also the sutta says that even the devas sometimes look after people who are kind-hearted and are virtuous. So many levels there of protection. So that is the way. Forget about those amulets. It's terrible. It really is terrible. It's got nothing to do with Buddhism. It's kind of, it's madness really. Yeah. So stay away from all of that. It's terrible that there is still so much superstition and silliness in our Buddhist world, unfortunately. So be a real Buddhist rather than a scary white Buddhist. Okay, so now that is the questions for you from yesterday. Now we will start on today's Well, okay, I'll start reading really fast. I too am a big fan of the suttas. In fact, I feel that the suttas are the best books ever written on Buddhism. Not just the best books ever written, but the best books ever of any kind, right? That is the way to look at it, okay. A few Buddhist friends and I formed a sutta discussion group. However, we sometimes encounter difficult suttas. I'm wondering if there is a way we can consult you should we face such issues. The best way is to go online, and very often these suttas would have been done by somebody, right? We do many of these suttas at the Dhammaloka Center in Perth. Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi has done many suttas that are available online. So listen to those explanations, and usually they will kind of bring out the solutions that are important anyway. But try that first of all. There is also a forum page on the Buddhist Society of Western Australia. We have a forum page online, and there is a monk who moderates that forum, and he answers the questions of almost everyone. I used to do that before, but I gave it up because it was too much work. So I got one of the younger monks to do this. Which is great. It's a great way of learning, right? You get questions, you have to answer. It's a wonderful way of learning. And some of these young monks are incredibly knowledgeable. I was absolutely flabbergasted how much they know. And they know Pali, and they're just really very clever. So check out that forum, first of all, right? And then if you are really desperate and you... I'm always happy to answer questions if necessary. And so if you get really desperate, you are, you're welcome to contact me one way or the other. If you really want to contact me, then contact someone who has my email address, like Angie or somebody like that, and tell Angie, oh, I need to get hold of Angie Ramali. Okay, this is the email address. That's okay. As long as it isn't too much, that's fine. Okay. Dear Ajahn Ramali, I work with NK12 teachers, with the 12 teachers at Health Social Services Agency. What does it say? K-12 teachers? Okay, anyway, let's move on and see what happens. Substance abuse, domestic violence, etc. And I'm very interested in instituting a virtue curriculum intervention to promote well-being and reduce suffering. Okay. Because of the separation of church and state, I cannot say or use Buddhist teachings. Do you know of virtue curriculums that is based on the Dhamma, Eightfold Noble Path, without Buddhist terminologies that I could skillfully use to brainwash teachers and service providers and students? You have repeatedly indicated that virtue needs to be the foundation before we can meditate. So I would like to get virtue into the schools and social service agencies and reinforce with meditation practice. Is this possible? Yes. Well, yes, certainly it's possible. I think there is also a lot of humanist societies these days around the place, and humanist societies are kind of non-religious societies, and they also sometimes have good ideas about virtue, right? Very often when it comes to virtue, you don't really have to call it anything. You can maybe retranslate some of the terminology to make it less Buddhist, and you can just, you know, say, call it whatever, call it just virtue, basically. And most people will understand that when they read it, that this is just virtue, and it doesn't really necessarily have to have any relation to Buddhism as such. But there is a lot of good teachings also in the humanist community, because they, even though they are atheists or agnostics or whatever, they still believe in morality, right? So because they believe in that, actually there is a lot of tools available already. So don't be afraid, you know, if you want to take some of the Dhamma teachings, just take it out and ask yourself, well, how can I change the wording a little bit so it isn't so Buddhist? Maybe I can just you have the meaning there in English, and then you just retranslate it a little bit, so it kind of comes out, the meaning is the same, but the wording is different. Don't be afraid of doing that, it's perfectly okay, as long as the message is the same at the end of the day. That's the most important thing here. So you can just do that for yourself. Yes?
The Dalai Lama has been promoting secular ethics.
Okay.
Okay,
that's good. Yeah, so the Dalai Lama has also been promoting those things. That's good. So it's already happening, in other words. It's already, some of the stuff is already out there. That's great. I actually saw just now, I saw something from Ajahn Sujato just before I came down here. And there was a video of this professor at Oxford University here. And this professor was saying that, well, in the West, we have this idea of free speech, but we don't have the idea of right speech, right? So he was actually trying to marry the idea of free speech with the idea of right speech, because free speech doesn't say anything about how you should speak. It just says you have the right to say all kind of bad things, right? But just because you have the right doesn't mean you should say bad things. So he was putting those two, very interesting, professor at Oxford University, right, putting these things together. So again, using Buddhist ideas in a secular environment. Okay. Dear Ajahn, I want to be committed to the path, but always fall short. You said that confidence and faith are needed for commitment to the path. Almost all of us would have confidence and faith in the Dhamma to be here. That's right. Can you elaborate on the confidence and faith required to the commitment to the path? Okay, I'm going to talk more about this tomorrow morning, because tomorrow morning is the last day. But basically the idea is that you just need to get input, right? Input regularly from Dhamma teachers, from the Buddha, from whoever, to kind of keep you going. That's really what it comes down to, because you need to feel the inspiration, you need to feel the sense of urgency, the sense of importance, and a good Dhamma teacher hopefully can give you that, the sense that, wow, this is really important, I've got to get my act together, I've got to do these things. And very often in daily life it's easy to lose your sense of focus, your sense of direction, and then when you feel like you do that, you go back, listen to a good teaching. Lots of good teachings available these days. Just on the Buddhist Society website, I think there are 800 talks by Adam Brahm or something like that. Absolutely astonishing. And usually, if you listen to those talks, they are very good, because on the one hand, they will make you feel good, because there will be jokes and stories and that kind of stuff. But on the other hand, there will also be an important Dhamma message at the same time. So they are great, you know. Great for that double thing. It lifts you up, makes you feel good, and also it gives you the message at the same time. This is one of the wonderful things about Ajahn Brahm and his kind of slightly revolutionary way of presenting the Dhamma. Not many people have that kind of ability to present the Dhamma in that way. So this is the most important thing. Make sure you get a regular input of Dhamma teachings. And this is one of the most important things that will support you. I'll talk more about that tomorrow morning, hopefully. And then, okay, can we pick up the defilements of others? That is, are they contagious? That would be scary, wouldn't it? They're contagious. Oh, like a virus going around. Yeah. Okay. Well, they can be a little bit contagious, right? If you are around other angry people, after a while you get a bit upset yourself, right? Sometimes that can happen. You can feel the vibe in a place, and it kind of drags you down, and you feel kind of the same kind of vibe. If you walk through the red light district, you might get the vibe of the red light district. You get kind of carried away by those defilements. But then if you are in good company, it's the opposite that happens. You actually get lifted up, and you get reduction in defilements. Have you noticed that? If you are in a positive place where people are kind and everybody is good to each other, it lifts you up. One of the things that I have always noticed when I, every Wednesday at our monastery in Perth, Adam Brown gives a Dhamma talk, and he has this incredible ability to lift people up and to create a good atmosphere. Everybody feels good afterwards. And that is one of the abilities of a person who is quite pure, like Ajahn Brahm, having that ability to lift people up and help them, and then they feel the sense of urgency of practice and practicing forward on the path. So yes, there is some truth to that, but it is also possible to insulate yourself from the environment around you. The more pure you are in your conduct, the better you behave, the less other people will affect you. Right? Someone like Ajahn Brahm, he can walk through the day, meet all kinds of people, doesn't really affect him very much at all. He's still the same person as before. And we can all do that to a certain extent, not allow ourselves to be affected by others. Okay. Hi, Ajahn. One, on numerous occasions I dreamt vividly of battlefields, village scenes surrounded by kings. Was told by two monks from different countries in a past life I was an army general who eventually became a monk. Is such recollection of past lives possible? That's interesting. Where do our dreams come from, right? What are they made up of? And of course, to me it is fairly obvious that dreams must somehow also originally come from some kind of experience that we have. It must come from something, right? Sometimes you have really maybe bad dreams. Maybe that comes from some kind of bad experience you had in the past life. Sometimes you have just weird dreams. Maybe it comes from some kind of weird experience in the past. And that gets mixed up with present experiences. And you get this kind of mixture of kind of weird stuff that you don't really know what is true and what is wrong and how it all works out. It gets very complicated. But I think it is possible. I think it's quite likely, in fact, that our dreams may be in part a result of things that happened in past lives. Something which is deep inside our psyche. And then when you fall asleep because you are relaxing, because you're kind of opening up to new possibilities, these things can come back to you. Just as if you are hypnotized, right, and you go through some kind of hypnotic regression, same kind of thing. I talked about this early on the retreat. So it is possible. Whether you were an army general, and how these monks knew that, I don't know. I don't know how they would know that, but I would take that with a pinch of salt if I were you. But it is, of course, possible that they would have seen that. On my visits to some countries, especially Buddhist historical sites, I know what was before me, despite the fact I've never been there previously. Can you explain such déjà vu experience? Thank you, with lots of metta. Okay, so you know what it is already. You have this feeling that you've been there before, perhaps, right? A very common feeling in the world. And there are many possibilities why that may be the case. Sometimes we have been in situations that are very similar. That can be one a cause for deja vu feeling. Of course, if you are in a foreign country we have never been before, then that is unlikely to be the explanation. So again, it could be a sense of, you know, something from a past life is certainly possible. Just like you feel Buddhist in this life because you were Buddhist before, these are certainly possible explanations. But there are probably many explanations, right? Maybe you have, sometimes we forget about things like, you know, sometimes we have access to the minds of other people. That's why sometimes, you know, you can feel a ghost, so you can feel departed people's presence sometimes. Sometimes we have more direct communication as well, mind to mind as well. That's why metta can work, and people can sometimes experience the metta of other people, just as they can experience the ill will, right? So there are a number of possibilities there. But I think a good possibility is that you may very well have been there before. Yeah. Okay. Dear Ajahn, Buddha died 2,500 years ago. Is he still here with us in our human realm, guiding us in our path? Oh, you want to be guided in the path. You don't want to lose the Buddha, right? You want him to be around so that he can guide us. But remember, one of the things the Buddha said when he passed away, some of the people were crying, right? They were really distraught, and they were kind of, it's described very vividly in the sutta, the Mahaparinibbana. They were crying and wailing, tearing out the hair, rolling back and forth on the ground, right? This is how it is described. So they were really grieving very, very heavily when the Buddha passed away, at least some of the people. But then the Buddha said to Ananda, "Ananda, why are you crying? Haven't I told you everything that is dear and beloved to you must become otherwise?" Remember the sutta we just read the other day? It's exactly the same expression, right, the Buddha uses. So the Buddha is impermanent. And that's why the arahants say, why are you crying? You know, of course everything is impermanent. So if the Buddha was still around, you wouldn't have to cry because it wouldn't be a problem. The problem is that the Buddha is no longer around. And that is is a big problem. And what it means that Buddhism is impermanent, it means that all of these teachings are impermanent, eventually it will all disappear. Now is the opportunity. Now you have these beautiful teachings available, use the opportunity now. That's what it means. If you think the Buddha is around, there's not much point in striving too hard, because the Buddha will be there, he will show us the way. But this is really mixing up more like a God religion with Buddhism. There's lots of Buddhists out there who think of the Buddha as a god. You pray to the Buddha is always there, that kind of stuff. But it's not Buddhism. It is a misunderstanding of what Buddhism is all about. Number two, it has been our Chinese tradition to go to the temple to pray to the Buddha. What was I just saying just one second ago, okay? For blessings. But if he's not around, such visit to the temples would not be necessary anymore. That's a good point, isn't it? Our wishes will not be granted, ? Exactly, they will not be granted. It is the harsh reality, right? The reality of reason kind of coming here. Yes, so don't, by all means, do not pray to the Buddha. It's an absolute waste of time. The right way of dealing with the Buddha is, as we said in the beginning, to recall his good qualities and just feel happy that his teachings are around, right? This is the right way of thinking about the Buddha. And then you are doing the right thing. You can still go to visit the temple, but go to the temple in a different way, with a different mind state. Go there if you enjoy being there because it's peaceful. If it is a temple in Singapore, probably not that peaceful, right? But go there if you enjoy going there, if you meet your friends there, if there is a nice monk there, if you feel peaceful. If it has some positive effect for you, you can still go. But don't just go to wave your sticks around and pray to the Buddha. That is no point in that at all. Okay. Is there a difference between breath meditation versus visualization or citation of mantras? All techniques are trying to get you to develop focus. Yes, yes, that is true. So all techniques are to develop focus. And of course, in the Tibetan tradition, they focus a lot on visualization. In the Thai forest tradition, they often use mantras like Buddha, 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 right? So these are all, they can all be valid techniques. But I think the important point here for me is that whenever I try to figure out what is the correct thing to do on the Buddhist path, I tend to go back to the suttas. So I ask myself, what did the Buddha have to say about these things? And the Buddha, essentially, his main meditation technique, the one he teaches the most, the one that fulfills all the four satipatthanas, right? Talked about this before today, is the breath meditation. This is the most powerful one. This is the one that will take you all the way to awakening. Of course, the problem with the breath meditation, it can be difficult. But all meditation is difficult if you haven't got samadhi, if you haven't got some kind of peace in your mind, any kind of technique will be difficult. So if that is the case, then understand the problem is probably the purity of your morality again. Purify that, and then the breath meditation will work for you as well. Now, the chanting of mantras, for example, is really, what it really is like a deterioration, if you like, of the Buddha Anusati, recollection of the Buddha. The idea of recollecting the Buddha is to kind of remind yourself of the marvelous qualities of the spiritual genius who lived 2,500 years ago. Right? It's a very beautiful thing when you remember those qualities and you remember the compassion, the wisdom, and the fact that he had understood about human happiness and suffering to the very core. That's why he's worthy to be your teacher, right? So you really understand these things in a deep way. That is much more beautiful. But the idea of Buddha is almost like an automation of the Buddha recollection, right? You go on auto and you say Buddha, Buddha, and that is kind of the idea. So it can work. So if that works for you and you find that it makes you peaceful, you can do some. But there comes a point when you have to let go of the mantra and go into even deeper peace. As long as you are saying something in your mind, you're not going to go into very deep samadhi states, but it can be maybe good as a starting point. As far as visualization is concerned, again, there is nothing really too much about that in the suttas. What you see in the suttas are like things like the 32 parts of the body. And that is like a visualization that the Buddha sometimes would recommend, right? Or perhaps the cemetery contemplation, that kind of stuff. But other kinds of visualization, like all this visualization of deities and gurus and all that kind of things, I personally don't see the Buddha recommending that, and I personally wouldn't particularly recommend that kind of meditation practice myself. But again, you know, it's very hard to be absolute about these things. If something works for you, if it makes you feel peaceful, if it takes you forward on the path to some extent, then it probably isn't very harmful, as long as you have a broad understanding of the Buddha's teachings. And then maybe later on you can move on to the breath meditation or whatever. So really, you know, you feel it out. How does it work? Does it have a good effect on you? If it is good, then you can probably continue with that. Okay, dear Ajahn, my Buddhist friend from another Buddhist clan wears mala beads. Okay? I was told that when one meditates, that energy, intention can be stored there. Okay, is this true? Why do you not use meditation beads? I do see other monks wearing these beads too. Thank you. Yeah. All kinds of strange ideas, right? The energy being stored in the mala beads. Well, I haven't even heard that one before. I've been a monk for over 20 years. Still new things you learn every day. go back to basics, right? Go back to basic Buddhism. Be kind, be gentle, be friendly, have positive intentions in your mind. That is real Buddhism. Mala beads is kind of a side issue. It's completely irrelevant whether you have mala beads or not. If you like them, sure, wear them. It doesn't matter. It's not going to hurt anyone, right? So I don't wear them because I haven't got any. And if I had them, I would give them away. I wouldn't bother having them, to be honest with you. So It's just a matter, these are just like wearing clothes basically, right? It's no different from that really. You wear something which you think is nice, and of course, you know, again, anything, if it's used skillfully, can be useful. So if you kind of see the mother base and it reminds you to be kind, then great, right? So these are the kind of ways you use things skillfully. Anything used skillfully can be useful. But there's nothing kind of magical about mala beads. It's just how you use it again. It's always the critical factor here. Okay, dear Ajahn, I came thinking this was a silent 8-precept retreat. I only realized last night that it wasn't. That's wonderful, isn't it? You get all these 8 precepts for free. Wow, that's so what good fortune. I have been keeping to the 8 precepts and was wondering where the chocolates and cheese were. Okay, now this is, I can tell you where they are, right? Come and knock on my door. That's where all the chocolates and cheese is. I have been given so much chocolate and cheese, I actually need to give some away. So if you really would like some chocolate and cheese, please, I'd be very, very happy to share some with you. I'm actually quite serious about that because I do have way too much. You will be doing me a favor if you take me some of my chocolate and cheese. So please approach me afterwards and then we can see what we can do about that. Okay, so that was number one. Okay, so thank you for your kindness, wisdom, and good humor. I just have one question. Is it still doing good if sometimes I do karma I feel I ought to? Rather than the goodness of my heart, I feel like a fraud sometimes, truth be told. But I'm inspired by your teachings to be better. Thank you. It's always good to do good, right? It can never be wrong because there's something inside of you which believes that goodness is important. So even though you feel like it doesn't come all that naturally, still it is good to do because there is a sense that this is important in your life. But the most important thing is actually to make it into something you really want to do. That is much, much better. So just learn that, you know, try to understand why these things are important. Try to understand that you have the opportunity to give a gift to people all the time by the way you speak, by the way you act, through the generosity, and all of these kind of things. And that you do have a tremendous impact on the people around you. So if you have a little bit of compassion and you understand that impact, you will want to be kind all the time. Just like you want to receive kindness from others, you want to be kind to others as well. So little tricks like that, thinking about things in the right way, makes all the difference. Right? And then when you start to understand the power of this, you try to use every opportunity you have to be kind, to do the right thing. If you really don't feel like doing it, don't push it too much, because eventually you might feel averse to being kind if you kind of go against your grain all the time. But sometimes it's okay. Don't have to do it all the time if it doesn't come natural. But try to just build up a perception of the power of kindness and how helpful it is in the world, and how you become part of a positive force in the world that builds up the world rather than drags it down. Sometimes little acts of kindness can have a tremendous effect in our society. You are kind to one person, they get inspired, pass it on to someone else, right? And this way it goes around a long way. So never underestimate the power of these things. If you don't feel 100% inspired, that's okay, but try to lift that inspiration and it becomes even more powerful then. Okay. Dear Ajahn, you mentioned that we can dedicate merit to the loved ones who have passed away and that they would be happy to receive them. But can that happen if only the mind passes on without any identity? E.g., John is no longer John when he dies. The energy mind that passes on has no self, no soul. The relative will not know who they are anywhere after they die. So they wouldn't know who you are anymore when you dedicate the merit to them. not quite right, because some of that identity you will carry with you, right? A lot of the identity you have to leave behind. But still, you will still, because you have developed your mind in a certain way, because of your attachments, a lot of those things will linger in your mind even though you're passing away. Ideally, you leave all that behind, because ideally you know you can't control it. But in reality, a lot of that we take it with us when we pass away. And that is why we often get reborn in the same families again and again, because we have attachments to each other, right? We love each other, and then when you get reborn, you go into another realm, and there you are. There is your mother and father, your sister and brother, your children, whatever it is. Very often you get reunited again in future lives. That comes through that attachment. So this attachment tends to hold us together. And when you die, and your merit isn't very good, you get reborn as a ghost. Very often when you get reborn as a ghost, usually it's often in that house, right, where you were a family member before. Very common. Why? Because of the attachment. Remember, the biggest thing about being a ghost is that you can't really let go. You're attaching to things. You have a lot of desires. So you're holding on. And that is why you tend to hang out there, right? And sometimes you scare your family members, right? Your family, oh, grandma, please move on. Please, you know, we don't want you to be around anymore. You have done it. You've had enough of this. So then the monks come in and do a chanting, okay, grandma, please be happy and well. May you move on into the future. And then you share merit with her. And your grandma says, oh, thank you so much for sharing merit. And then she moves on into a happy destination, right? This is the idea. So, yes, there is still that sense of identity there, and that's how we can make that connection with people. Okay, dear Ajahn, it seems that from the readings of the suttas that going forward is a natural unfolding of events, or the intention to go forward should eventually get stronger when one is more established in the gradual training. My question is it right to say that entering the monastic life is the final vehicle to Nibbana? Thank you so much for the teaching these few days. I've learned so much. Okay. In a sense, it often tends to be the final vehicle to Nibbana, right? You move on, and then you come to monastic life, and then you kind of finish off in monastic life. Sometimes it is like that, but not always, because people become monastics for all kinds of reasons. It's not just to practice sincerely, it's not just because they have gone a long way on the path and all of these kind of things. Sometimes you become monastic for all kinds of reasons. And sometimes it's good. One of the great, so many advantages of being a monastic, even if you haven't gotten to the point where you're getting close to Nibbana yet, still being a monastic can be very, very powerful regardless. And some of those things are, as I mentioned before, it's incredibly meaningful. I feel that almost everything I do in my life has a very clear purpose. It's about encouraging my own practice, and it is about helping other people on the path. And of course, these two, they go together, right? When you help others, you're helping yourself. When you're helping yourself, you're helping others. They go together. So this is, to me, an extraordinarily meaningful life. I don't feel I'm wasting any time. I don't feel that I am, you know, when I work for a living, it's doing really good stuff, right? I'm always feeling I do really good stuff when I do work, if you like, when I come here and teach or whatever it is. Never feels like something bad. I always, you know, you always feel like you grow at the same time as everybody else is growing. Yeah. This is one thing. Yeah. Another thing which is great about monastic life is all the kalyanamitas you have, all the good people around you. They are not perfect. They are not, you know, they have their weaknesses sometimes, but they have very good intentions normally. And this is perhaps even more true in the Western world than it is in Asia. And the reason for that is because in Asia, Buddhism has been around for so long, and people become monks and nuns for all kinds of reasons. In the West, it's very new. If you become a Buddhist monastic, it's not because your parents are pushing you in to become a monastic, right? That is in fact, is usually the exact opposite. So usually when people do that in the West, it's because they really want to be monastics. So that's why it is still quite pure in the West. Eventually it will degenerate there as well, of course, just like everywhere else. But it's still quite pure. So you have good friends, right? You get to hang around teachers like Ajahn Brahm all the time. then there is a seclusion. You have incredibly good environment to meditate in, right? And you can basically, I put in Jnana Monastery, you can spend exactly as much time in seclusion as you want to. We have a roster for going on retreat. All you have to do is put up your name. You can almost go on retreat whenever you like. It's a very kind of free and open system to maximize the benefits of the monastic life. So these are all benefits. And even if you're not very close to Nibbana, you can really, if you understand those benefits and you're interested in that, then a monastic life is still a very, very good option. And it's certainly going to accelerate your path to Nibbana dramatically if you do that. But, and maybe that was a question as well, is of course, as you practice the path as a layperson, if you don't become a monastic, if you go a long way, then yes, there tends to come a point when you naturally become a monastic, because you're not interested in lay life anymore, basically. Okay. Dear Ajahn, when I visit temples, there are many different god statues that we put joss sticks in front of, and we pray to them. What are they? Do they have powers? Or is it all a sham? Thank you very much. I have no idea what these god statues are. I know that sometimes these temples, they have all kinds of, it's not really, sometimes they are mixtures of all kinds of things, right? Sometimes they are like a little bit Taoist, a little bit Buddhist, and a little bit Mahayana, a bit Theravada, and it's just completely confusing. You have no idea what is going on there. And I remember going to China once, and we went to this temple, right? And this was a Taoist temple there. And there were a few figures there that I could recognize that had some kind of Buddhist connection. And the rest were just random kind of figures of all kinds of stuff. And they looked like gods. So maybe that is the gods you are seeing. Maybe kind of these Taoist gods. Or maybe they are some kind of Mahayana Bodhisattvas. I really don't know what it is. But as I said before, don't worry about that. Just put it to one side. No need to pray to those things. Just be good, right? That is the essence of the Buddhist practice. That will make you much more happy than praying to these gods. Usually if you pray too much to these gods, you just get very disappointed because you never get what you want. Okay, does one have to be a monk to be a stream enterer? Don't have to be. It's possible, according to the sutta, to be a stream enterer if you are a lay person. But I think it is probably very difficult, right? It's difficult enough as it is to become a stream enterer. So I think being a monk or being a nun is a very great help on the path to go there. But it's not absolutely required. There are some people in lay life who are very pure and very, very good people. And they get good meditation, and sometimes they may be able to make the breakthrough in the Dhamma to stream entry and these kind of things. But it's very rare, because you don't really have the support network that you have as a monastic. At the time of the Buddha, there were some astonishing lay people around who were stream enterers, who even were once returners. Remember, there was one, or non-returners even. There was one of them, he was, actually there's a few stories about those. One of them was Uga the householder. And he became a non-returner, right? And then he said to all his wives, well, you know, I don't really, no need to hang around with me anymore. So if you want to go and find yourself another husband, please go off. So all his wives went off and found themselves other husbands. And he was kind of left behind. And he was probably much more happy that way anyway. Well, if you are a non-returner, there's not much point in having wives anymore. And then there's another famous one. It is Chittala householder. He was also a non-returner according to the sutta. And these were all really good meditators and everything. And according to this sutta, he was asked by somebody, well, when you go and visit the monks, do they teach you the Dhamma? And Chitta replied that, well, when I go and visit the monks, either they teach me the Dhamma, and if they don't teach me the Dhamma, I teach them the Dhamma. Right? It's kind of nice, right? It doesn't have to be the monk or the nun or whatever with the authority. The authority is whoever has the knowledge and the understanding. That is where the real authority is. So here you have this Chittala householder telling the monks what to do. And the monks are probably very impressive person, right? So if somebody's very impressive, of course you will listen to the teachings. Okay. Could too much loving kindness encourage a person to persist in bad habits? There is a saying, you sometimes have to be cruel to be kind. Okay, so too much loving kindness encourage, you mean other people then presumably, because if you have lots of loving kindness, personally you won't have many bad habits left, because you have lots of loving kindness means that basically no more ill will, no more anger, not too much sensuality either, because loving kindness kind of trumps all of that. So personally, you will not be having many bad habits. But maybe your point is that you are not encouraging others. Maybe that's your point. You're not encouraging other people to be kind. Maybe your children need a bit of a telling off every now and again. And if you're too kind to them, they're just going to keep on being naughty forever. Maybe that's your fear. But I think that the best parents in the world are the parents who show a lot of love to their children. Okay, the children may be naughty sometimes, right? All children are naughty sometimes. It's at the stage they go through. But if you can have loving kindness for them and forgive them for their naughtiness and just let it pass, they will learn so much more from your attitude of loving kindness than they will ever learn from you telling them off. That is what they learn. They learn from how you act, from how you are, not from what you say, right? This is how children always are. Right? And that is why many of you are Buddhist as well. You are Buddhist because you are used to coming around and listening to people like Ajahn Brahm or other good monks or nuns or good lay people or whatever, and you get inspired from that. It makes you a better person. It's exactly the same thing with these kids. So do we ever need to be told off? Perhaps occasionally it's okay. But we tend to overemphasize the effectiveness of telling people off and, you know, a tough love, as they call it, which is really love at all, right? It's just tough. So we overemphasize that, and we don't emphasize enough the actual real kindness. I don't know, I have seen people who have grown up with very, very kind parents, and usually they end up becoming very balanced and very good people themselves as a consequence. So kindness for your kids, I think, is just so important and so powerful. I grew up with my parents were very good, and I think I'm a reasonably balanced person, so that was probably a good thing for me as well there. Okay, number two, would you advise applying if the persons with bad habits are your parents? What would be your advice to apply if the person with the bad habits are your parents? Are one's fathers and mothers in a separate category, and should they be treated differently? E.g., ignore the bad habits and just show loving kindness and compassion. That's a very good question, and it's a difficult one. Because your parents, because they have brought you up, there's often a limit to how much you can say to your parents, right? For them, you are always the child. You are kind of, they are the parents, and they are the teachers, and you are the one who's learning from them. But if you have wise parents, they will actually listen to you at the right time and the right place. So you have to be very careful. But again, it is a lot to do with how you act. You have to show your integrity first of all. When you show your integrity that you are doing the right thing, there's a much more chance your parents will listen to you. If you show them you are changing, you are treating them with more kindness, right? And you are actually doing something kind to them, then they will again will be more interested in listening to what you have to say. Yes, you encourage them, but be very, very careful when you encourage your parents, because it can backfire very easily, and they will not listen to you, and they will become kind of shut down, not have anything to do with it. So be very careful, very gentle, and if it doesn't work, well, be prepared for that, because it may very well not work. But it's a wonderful thing. If you are able to encourage your parents on the path, it's a very powerful good karma. So give it a shot, right, in a wise way, without imposing yourself too much. So if you can do it, very powerful and good karma. Our parents are very special people, according to the suttas. There's a couple of suttas of my parents that I was hoping to read out on this retreat. Maybe tomorrow morning we can squeeze that in as well. And they are very beautiful ways of looking at our parents in a way that gives rise to more joy in helping and supporting them. So they are very important, and for that reason, it is possible to make lots and lots of good karma by looking after your parents in the right way, and it's impossible to make heaps of bad karma by looking after them in the wrong way and not being nice to them. Okay. Yes, sir. Okay, that is a good point. So so there is kindness, there are different kinds of kindness. There is like the indulgent kindness where you give them everything, right? And you don't really care for them so much at all, actually. You just have the easy way of kind of giving them stuff and then kind of keep them happy that way. That is a very good point. It's not, that is not what it is about. What it's about is a real kindness of heart where you really care for your child. That is the one that matters. So indulging a little bit now and again, of course, is fine, but it's, that shouldn't be the final say in these things. Yeah. Thank you for pointing that out there. Yeah. This is the advantage of having people here who are parents. They actually have some understanding of these issues. I haven't, you know, for me, it's much more theoretical. Okay. So my friend is technologically biased. Okay, technological device, probably, does that mean he spends, or she spends a lot of time on the computer, is that what it means? Okay, and believes that one day there will be a technology that could get the brain to experience states of deep samadhi, maybe jhanas, and or help folks to seriously, effectively meditate. What do you think about this? There are no shortcuts, right? So you want to, basically, I think that is exactly right. I think that there is no way that you can really circumvent practicing the path. Remember that what makes samadhi possible is not just a matter of concentration, it's a matter of abandoning the defilements of the mind. How are you going to get a machine to make you abandon the defilements of the mind? Usually the machines make defilements greater, right? Not less. This is my experience with these machines. So it has to be a personal effort and drive in the right direction to abandon defilements. I cannot see how a machine can ever do that, unless maybe the machine can create a beautiful image of the Buddha and you see all the beautiful qualities of the Buddha and it really inspires you, right, so much that kind of 3D holographic image of the Buddha, something like that, the Buddha walking around teaching you, and you think, whoa, this is just too good to be true. And I don't know, maybe in that way it could maybe inspire enough confidence for the defilements to abandon, but not in some other way. But basically, don't wait for the machines, right? Get on to the path now. Now is the time to do this. If you're going to wait for the machines, you're going to wait forever, basically. So this is kind of part of the problem. There are so many kind of excuses for not doing it now, and this is just another excuse, really. Yeah. Yes, sir? Right. In that case, the machine would be useless anyway, because you're moving into the realm of the mind anyway. Yeah, it's a good point, actually. Yeah. Okay, last question for tonight, which is very good news, because it's 9 o'clock, we've been doing 1.5 hour already. So that's great. So, okay, dear Ajahn, question number one, at least you're going to get your money's worth, aren't you, with all these questions? Okay. For an experienced meditator like yourself, is it very easy to still the mind? How long does it take? Okay, so, remember that things are very variable, right? It depends on the situation around you, it depends on all kinds of things. Nothing is ever straightforward in this life. Sometimes it doesn't get still at all. Sometimes you have lots of stuff and torpor. Sometimes it's much better. So it just varies. And you cannot really say anything about how long it takes, because it is just so incredibly variable. If you are on retreat by yourself and there's nobody around, your mind is pretty much still all the time. There's no big problem there. And then if you are, busy doing stuff, then of course the mind is far, far more active. So it just varies enormously, and you cannot really say anything about this. Number two, is it advisable to continue to try meditation when the mind is having a party? I tried to put in effort and it became very tiring. How would you advise if I feel anxiety and sadness? Well, if the mind is having a party, and now the mind should party on. And just because, again, if you try to put in effort, it means you're trying to suppress what is going on, and that doesn't usually work. So allow the mind to party, and then just be aware and see what's going on. Why is the mind partying? Right? How come the mind is restless? Sometimes the restlessness just wears itself out because you're coming into a good environment, the mind then calms down by itself. Sometimes you are feeding the restlessness by thinking in a certain way, and by being aware, you can see, you can observe whether you are feeling it or not. And if you are feeling it, you say, okay, what can I do to change this? How can I look at the situation differently? What am I doing wrong here? And you can maybe change your perception, right? You think to yourself, wow, I've come all this way to come here. What a wonderful place this is to be and to hang out with good friends and things. This is not the time for me to think about all kinds of stuff. Let me enjoy this short period of time. When I go back to Singapore, then I can start thinking again. Right? So this is how you kind of train the mind. It may not work, but it is a kind of movement in the right direction. How would you advise if I feel anxiety and sadness? It really depends. What are you sad about? Right? I'm not sure what you are sad about. If you are sad about somebody having passed away, then just imagine them being up there in the heavenly realm, being happy and waiting for you to die, perhaps, right? So you can join them in the nice heavenly realm, right? Come on, okay, do more good, and then you come up and then join me afterwards in the heavenly realm, right? So sometimes we are sad because of perceptions that are silly. We are sad because somebody has passed away, but often there's no need to be sad if somebody's passed away. So just try to understand the cause of the sadness, then change your perception and look at things in a different way. Sometimes this takes a bit of time, but you will eventually get there. Anxiety is always about some kind of fear about the future, right? There's something in the future that you're worried about. So try to change your outlook about the future. You're on the Buddhist path. You have good friends. You're practicing the five precepts. You're purifying yourself. You're doing good deeds. You have a good future, right? It's guaranteed. Your future is bright and beautiful. Nothing to be anxious about. So just remind yourself, well, this is a good reason for committing yourself even more to the Buddhist path. Because now then you know the future will be positive and bright. And anxiety will fall by the wayside all by itself. Is it advisable to have a meditation marathon? Thank you. probably not. I would just advise you to do a little bit of meditation every day. If you have a marathon, you probably will have a lot of suffering at the same time. So just enjoy a little bit every day. A little bit to support your practice of morality and virtue. A little bit just to rest and be peaceful and have a bit of metta for the people around you. That is far more powerful. Do whatever meditation you enjoy. Don't go much beyond the limit of enjoyment, because if you do that, you're going to be counterproductive. If you don't enjoy meditation at all, it's fine. Don't have to meditate, right? Much more important to be kind and to do all these other kind of things. That is the most important thing. And then meditation will kind of come eventually if you keep on doing the right thing, living a good life. Okay, that is all for tonight. I can say with a certain amount of relief. So, okay.
So Andrew,
you want to?
Yeah.